question we must all ask is, did God actually do anything remarkable that first Easter or not? Did Jesus rise from the dead or not? For if he did, that changes everything. If he didn't, then Christianity is a lie. Christianity without the resurrection should not be seriously considered by any thoughtful person at all, but Christianity with the resurrection challenges everything that we believe. If, in the words of that drama, God has actually shone his light into our world in the person of Jesus, if God has actually broken in to the mess that we call this world and our lives, then we must take the resurrection seriously. If that is God's light, not only the life and death of Jesus, but the resurrection of Jesus, if that is God shining his light on us, we'd be foolish not to consider that seriously. Once we believe in the risen Lord Jesus, life is never the same. There isn't another life outside of Jesus that we would or could live. The resurrection, if true, affects our entire life and our thinking. Now, the gospel writers all think the resurrection happened. We've read one account today from the Gospel of Mark, but the other three gospel writers, Matthew, Luke, and John, all actually believe that Jesus was physically dead. He really died a death, and then after a short time, he was alive again. And it's clear from the rest of the New Testament and the early church history that those first disciples, those men and those women, were so motivated by this belief that they in fact slowly began to change the world. There are two key reasons they believed he had risen, and I want to briefly consider them today because I think these are two good reasons why all of us could believe, should believe, that Christ has been raised from the dead. One reason is that the tomb was empty. There was no body found. And secondly, are the encounters that people had with the risen Jesus after he had been raised. Encounters that were convincing enough for these real men and real women to believe that this person they were meeting wasn't a ghost and wasn't an hallucination. They were actually convinced this was the real Jesus. As New Testament scholar Tom Wright suggests, here are two pillars upon which you can build a belief in the resurrection and therefore in Christianity. The two pillars are an empty tomb and the resurrection appearances of Jesus. Let's just consider those together a little bit this morning. In Mark chapter 16, we see Jesus appear to a number of people. He first appears to Mary Magdalene in verse 9. He then appears to two disciples walking in the country, verse 12. Each of these then report back to that special group of followers of Jesus known as the apostles. And they don't believe them. They just can't believe that Jesus has been raised. Then in verse 14, Jesus appears to this special group called here in Mark chapter 16, the 11. That is the original 12 apostles minus Judas who had betrayed Jesus. And Jesus rebukes these 11 for their lack of faith, that they didn't believe those first witnesses. And he shows them that he is alive, and then he commands them to go and preach the gospel. Now, isn't it really encouraging that in one of the earliest accounts of the resurrection, you've got skeptics, you've got his closest friends not believing? It just proves that these people weren't gullible. So how do we account for these appearances to Mary and the two men and the 11, and in the New Testament you see hundreds of other people? It is possible the disciples were deluded. 19th century German biblical critic David Strauss said that the resurrection was something that the disciples imagined. He understood it like this, that the disciples were so personally committed to Jesus that their grief did not allow them to believe that he had died. They were so, they just could not take it in that he had died, so they convinced themselves, despite the evidence, that he was still alive. Now, is such delusion plausible? Is it plausible to believe, even in the first century, that once a movement's leader has been killed, the followers of that leader, in order to deal with their grief, just believe that he's alive. Is that plausible? Now, from the heights of the 21st century, with our knowledge, we might think people in the ancient world were more gullible than us. But let's look at a couple of examples. That's not what the followers of John the Baptist did after he'd been killed, nor the followers of other first century Messiah figures after they had been killed. One example. There was a man by the name of Simon Bar Jora. He was one of the most popular Jewish leaders during the years just after Jesus. He was one of the leaders during the Jewish-Roman wars of AD 66 to 70. Many Jews regarded this man, Simon, as a great leader, even a king, and some were using the language of Messiah about Simon. He led them in revolt against the Romans. They were barricaded in Jerusalem. And then for 5 months, the Romans besieged Jerusalem. They were led by Titus, who would eventually become an emperor of Rome. Once Rome broke down Jerusalem, they took Simon as a captive. And Titus, rather than execute Simon there in Jerusalem, he took him back to Rome to parade him through the streets as part of his triumph, to show everybody, here, we've finally caught this so-called Messiah figure. And at the end of the triumph in Rome, Simon was flogged and then executed, as was the way of the Romans. Now, 3 days later, 3 weeks later, 3 months later, 3 years later, no one was claiming that Simon was alive. People in the ancient world did not think people came back to life. That wasn't the norm. As with us today, we take death as the end of someone's life. As a rule, they didn't claim someone had come back to life, and so it's not plausible that the disciples were deluded. In fact, as you look at the text of Mark 16, you see them being skeptical right from the start. Now, to nuance this further, ancient people did know that sometimes people had unusual experiences of someone who had died. They knew about visions and ghosts and dreams. They knew that a grieving person might see a figure or sense a presence of someone that has died and they are grieving. But they don't use the language of resurrection to describe those experiences. An example is Acts 12. Herod has been persecuting the Christians. He's already killed James, the brother of John, and he's about to kill the Apostle Peter. It's the Passover, so he decides out of respect for the religious holiday that he would wait till after the Passover to execute Peter. All the believers have barricaded themselves in a room and are praying fervently. Unbeknownst to them, God has answered their prayers for safety for Peter. He's been miraculously released from jail, and he comes running to their house and knocks on the door because the door is locked and says, "I'm free, I'm here." And inside, they think it must be his angel because they think he will be dead. He's dead. So they use this, they have this idea that, yes, maybe he's died and his angel has come to make a final farewell before he goes off into the afterlife. And no doubt they expected they would go and find his body the next day and give it a decent burial. So they have a category for describing someone who they meet after death. And it's not resurrection. In that instance, it was an angelic experience. So why do these disciples start to believe that Jesus is actually alive? How could they be so sure he was alive and not just some sort of angel or some sort of other spirit? And this is where we come back to the empty tomb. You see, the sightings of Jesus would have proved nothing had there been a body in the tomb. And an empty tomb itself proves nothing. There could have been other explanations for the lack of a body. Grave robbery, or the political opponents of Jesus, the religious opponents of Jesus, they could have easily taken the body somewhere else. 18th century critics of Christianity, the deists, revived the hypothesis that the disciples were in fact liars, that they'd come in the night and stolen the body and taken it away and then fabricated the story of the resurrection. That's a story as early as the Gospels themselves, as you see in Matthew 28. Now, there is no doubt the tomb was empty. No one ever found a body. And this, coupled with the resurrection appearances of Jesus, convinced the first disciples that God had indeed raised Jesus from the dead and he was alive again. All the other possible solutions to this historical conundrum, like grave robbery or delusion or fraud, are all less plausible than the New Testament conclusion. That is, that God did in fact raise Jesus from the dead, that he left an empty tomb behind him, that he appeared in a newly embodied state to hundreds of witnesses and raised in them the belief that he was indeed the Messiah and instilled in them the courage to call him, not the Roman Emperor, Lord. The empty tomb and the resurrection appearances are part of the compelling evidence to help any thoughtful person to believe in the resurrection of Jesus. Now, they don't amount to an actual mathematical proof as such. Historical argument alone doesn't force anyone, won't convince necessarily anyone here this morning that Jesus has been raised from the dead. But historical discussion and understanding what actually happened helps remove misconceptions, can undermine false assumptions, that sort of thing. And it helps people realize that the Christian faith is solidly based in historical reality. It's not a fantasy. These people have not believed a lie. Now, if you're here today and you're not sure you believe in the resurrection, or you're quite convinced that the resurrection never happened, I'd like to introduce you to a person called Lee Strobel. Lee was a journalist and a lawyer, and for a time was the legal editor of the Chicago Tribune. He says that his training in journalism and law bred him to be skeptical and cynical. And he says he and his colleagues prided themselves on their skepticism. They didn't believe anything on face value. That was symbolized by one of his colleagues who had a sticker on his wall that says, "If your mother says she loves you, check it out." Lee was an atheist for most of his life until his wife became a Christian, most inconveniently. This forced him then to rethink what he believed and led him to a 2-year investigation of Christianity, using all his journalistic and legal skills to analyze and to check out and to use his skills to see if this was in fact true or not. And near the end of that process, Lee says that he came with the overwhelming conclusion, or came to the overwhelming conclusion, that the evidence all pointed towards the reality of who Jesus is. Near the end of that process, he committed his life, and since then he's been a public Christian using his skills to write books and help other people come to faith. Now, I've got a couple of freebies that I'm happy to give away that Lee has written. One is called The Case for Easter, and the other is called The Case for the Resurrection. They'll be out in the foyer on a table with a few other books that we'd be happy to give away to anyone who would like to read and think a bit more. And even if you're not a skeptic, you're welcome to take a book, and these will help you just think and read and understand. And I'm happy to talk to anybody who would like to talk further. But what difference does all this make? What difference does it make that Jesus rose from the dead? Well, it means everything to those who believe. It means that when the service leader starts the service and says, "Christ is risen," you can say, "He has risen indeed," with feeling and gusto, can't you? But it'll mean nothing, absolutely nothing, if you don't have a relationship with Jesus yourself. Now, I'm not talking about religion. I'm talking about a relationship. It doesn't matter if you're a Catholic or a Protestant or a Hindu or a Mormon or a Jew or a nothing. Jesus didn't come to start a religion. He came to begin a relationship with every human being, and all of you here are included in that. You see, religion is our attempt to get to God, but Jesus is God's attempt to get to us, to get right inside us, and to let us know that he loves us and that he wants to know us. A Christian is somebody who says, "Yeah, I acknowledge that Jesus is the boss. He's the Lord. He's the CEO. He's the number one in my life. And what he asks me to do, that's what I'm going to do." And so if you're going to be a Christian, you need to stop believing that you're the boss. You actually need to say to God, God, I'm sorry I've tried to live my life my own way. I want to live it your way now. And you put your trust in Jesus. Now, you can do that today, but you might not be ready to do that. You might like to take something to read and think about and come back again and talk and argue and question. We're quite happy, if you don't believe, we're quite happy to encourage people to ask questions and debate. That's fine. But if you're here this morning and you do believe, if you are a Christian, let's use the rest of this service and our lives to celebrate, to live that truth that Jesus has been raised from the dead. So say it with me. Christ is risen. He is risen indeed. Hallelujah.